Welcome back, listeners. If you're hearing this, you made it through another week. Congratulations. Not everyone can say the same. Tonight's episode isn't about ghosts or demons or things that hide in the shadows. Tonight is about something far more terrifying: the human will to survive, and the unspeakable things we become when that will is tested. So turn off the lights, lock your doors, and whatever you do, don't think too hard about what you would do in their position. Because once you start down that road, there's no coming back. Let's begin. Story 1.
I was 19 when I started working the evening shift at Bombay Bites. That's what we called it. Though the actual name on the signboard was Substation. One of those sandwich chains that had been spreading across Mumbai like moss on a monsoon wall. The franchise was in Andheri West, tucked between a closed pharmacy and a STD booth that nobody used anymore. I needed money for college fees. My mother needed the help, and basically the job seemed simple enough. Make sandwiches, smile, go home. I wasn't expecting it to be the best job in the world. I was expecting boring. I was expecting fine. Looking back, I realize I should have paid more attention to the fact that nobody lasted long there. 3 employees had quit in the month before I joined. My manager, Vikram sir, told me people just moved on. I believed him. I was 19 and stupid and needed the money. The first thing I noticed about the night manager was that he didn't say much. His name was Fernandez. No first name, just Fernandez. That's what Vikram sir called him. That's what everyone called him. He came in at 9 every night, right when the dinner rush was dying, checked the stockroom, walked the floor once, and then sort of settled into the back office. You'd see the light under the door. You'd hear nothing. He was pale in a way that didn't make sense for Mumbai. You know? Like he'd been kept somewhere dark for a long time. But whatever. Pale people exist. I wasn't going to make a whole thing out of it. The real strangeness started with the regular. He came in every Thursday around 10:30. Heavy-set man, maybe 50. Always in a white kurta that had this faint, yellowish stain near the collar I tried not to look at. He'd walk up to the counter and order 2 footlongs, chicken tikka, and something called a special that wasn't on any menu I'd been trained on. When I asked about it the first time, my senior Priya just shook her head slightly and said, "Make him the chicken tikka. Give him extra napkins and don't look at who he's pointing to." "Pointing to?" I said. "Just do it," she whispered. So I did. And yes, he was gesturing beside him, talking to the empty space next to him, saying things like, "No, you'll like this one," and "Don't worry, I told you I'd handle it." He'd pull out his wallet and pay for 2 meals, take both trays, set one across from himself in the corner booth, and eat in silence facing the wall. Maybe I was just paranoid. I told myself he had a Bluetooth earphone I couldn't see. I told myself Mumbai is full of eccentric uncles. Then, about 3 weeks in, the meat delivery came in wrong. It was a Tuesday. I was alone in the back. Priya had stepped out for chai, and the delivery boy handed me the cold box and left faster than usual. I started stacking the packets, and one of them was, I don't know how to explain it. The weight was wrong. The shape inside the vacuum seal was wrong. It wasn't the flat, uniform slab of processed chicken we always got. It was curved, jointed. I felt my heart drop. I put the packet aside and didn't touch it again. When Priya came back, I told her. She looked at it for exactly 2 seconds, walked it to the bin outside, buried it under other garbage, and said, "Never open the wrong ones." "The wrong ones?" I said. "What does that mean? How often does this..." "Rohan," she looked at me the way you look at a child who is about to touch something hot. "Just never open them." I should have quit then. I know that now. The photograph thing was what broke me. One of the other guys, Deepak, had this tradition of taking a group selfie every time someone completed 3 months at the store. Little celebration. Vikram sir always joined in because he was that kind of manager. Genuinely nice. Always smiled for photos. Fernandez never joined, obviously. He was always in the back office during selfie time. We'd assumed it was just his personality. But one night, close to midnight it was, I was scrolling through Deepak's photo folder on his phone while he showed me something funny, and I stopped scrolling. I went back and forward and back again. Every photo? Vikram sir in every single one. The other staff in every one. Sometimes customers in the background. Random strangers. Fernandez was in some of those background shots. He must have walked through the frame without realizing. Except he wasn't there. I mean, his outline wasn't there. Everyone else was crisp. Where Fernandez walked, there was just a blur, a smear. Like the camera had decided something in that space wasn't allowed to be seen. I heard a door open behind me. I did not turn around for a long moment. I was standing at the counter, holding Deepak's phone, and I could hear footsteps coming from the back office. Slow, unhurried. The way something walks when it knows you have nowhere to go. Something wasn't right. Every part of my body knew it before my brain did. My hands went cold. My mouth dried out. I turned. Fernandez was standing at the end of the counter, watching me. He wasn't doing anything threatening. He was just watching, with this expression that wasn't quite a smile but had all the same geometry. His eyes were open a little wider than eyes should be. "Long shift," he said. "Just that," I said. "Yeah?" He nodded, went back to the office. The light came on under the door. I clocked out 40 minutes early. I told Vikram sir I felt sick, which was the truest thing I'd said all month. I never went back. I WhatsApped my resignation at 2 a.m. and blocked the number when Vikram sir tried to call. I still live in Andheri. I mean, I couldn't exactly move. My family is here. But I don't walk past that stretch of road at night. And sometimes on Thursdays, if I'm near that area, I think about the regular in the white kurta, who he was talking to in that empty seat, what he ordered for them, and whether they could actually eat it. To this day, I still don't open any vacuum-sealed packet that feels wrong in my hands. I'll never forget the way Fernandez said long shift, like he'd been counting the minutes along with me, like he'd been waiting to see how long it would take before I understood. Looking back, I realize he wasn't threatening me. He was just letting me know that he knew that I knew. And that was enough.
Story 2.
I should have known something was wrong the moment my phone started ringing. I mean, I was literally holding it in my hand, scrolling through Instagram while sitting cross-legged on my bed. It was around 7 p.m. on a Tuesday, and I'd just gotten home from tuition classes in Bangalore. My parents were downstairs making dinner. I could smell the tatka from the dal wafting up to my room, but my phone was ringing. The screen showed an incoming call, and when I looked at the caller ID, I felt my heart sink. It was my own number. I stared at it for a few seconds, thinking maybe it was some kind of glitch or a telemarketing trick. You know how these scam callers spoof numbers now? I'd heard about it happening to my classmates. Obviously, I should have just ignored it, but curiosity got the better of me. Looking back, I realized how stupid that was. I answered. For a moment, there was only breathing. Heavy, deliberate breathing that made the hair on my arms stand up. Then I heard it, my own voice, exactly as I sound, with the same slight rasp I get when I'm nervous. "Don't come home tonight." The call disconnected. I dropped the phone like it had burned me. My hands were shaking as I picked it up again, checking my call log. There it was. Incoming call from my own number. Duration, 12 seconds. I tried calling back, but it just rang and rang. Basically calling myself, which made no sense, and somehow made everything worse. "Maybe I was just paranoid," I muttered, trying to rationalize what had just happened. Deep fake technology. AI voice cloning. I'd read articles about this stuff. Someone must have hacked my number, recorded my voice from somewhere. That had to be it. But I was standing in my bedroom. I was home. "Didi, dinner's ready," my younger brother Rohan called from downstairs. I went down, trying to shake off the creeping dread settling in my chest. My parents were serving rice and dal, and everything looked normal. My mom was talking about her office drama. My dad was watching news on his phone. Rohan was being his usual annoying self, trying to flick dal at me when no one was looking. Something wasn't right, though. I couldn't focus on anything they were saying. The words, "Don't come home tonight," kept echoing in my head in my own voice. About an hour later, after dinner, I was back in my room doing homework when my phone buzzed. A text message from my own number. "Please, you have to leave, all of you." My hands went cold. I screenshotted it immediately, proof that I wasn't losing my mind, and ran downstairs. "Mom, Dad, something weird is happening with my phone," I said, my voice shaking. I showed them the call log, the text message. My father frowned. "It's probably some new scam, beta. Don't worry about it." "But Dad, it's my own number." "These hackers can do anything nowadays," my mother interrupted, not looking up from loading the dishwasher. "Just block it and forget about it." I didn't want to seem crazy, so I nodded and went back upstairs, but I couldn't ignore the growing pit in my stomach. I should have trusted my instincts. At around 10 p.m., my phone rang again, same number. This time, when I answered, my voice on the other end sounded desperate, almost crying. "The carbon monoxide detector, check it, now." The line went dead. I felt my heart pounding so hard, I thought it would burst out of my chest. Carbon monoxide. We had a detector in the hallway, installed when we moved into this house 3 years ago. I'd barely ever noticed it. I ran out of my room, and there it was. The small white device mounted on the wall. I pulled a chair over and examined it closely. That's when I saw it. The batteries had been removed. The back panel was slightly open, and inside was completely empty. My blood ran cold. "Dad," I screamed. "Mom, we need to get out now." I don't know what it was. Maybe the pure terror in my voice. But they didn't question me this time. My father immediately went to check the gas connections in the kitchen. And that's when he smelled it. That faint, sweet smell that shouldn't be there. "Everyone out. Right now," he said, his voice urgent. We grabbed Rohan and ran outside into the humid Bangalore night. Our neighbors, the Sharmas, let us stay with them while my father called the gas company's emergency line. They came within 30 minutes. The technician's face was grim as he emerged from our house. Massive leak from your water heater connection. Another hour, maybe two, and... He didn't finish the sentence. He didn't need to. Carbon monoxide is odorless. What my father had smelled was something else. Something that saved our lives because I'd already raised the alarm. But we would have all gone to sleep eventually. And we wouldn't have woken up. We stayed with the Sharmas that night. I couldn't sleep. I kept checking my phone. But there were no more calls. No more messages. I looked through all my social media accounts, my voice notes, everything, trying to figure out how someone could have cloned my voice so perfectly, known about the detector, known about the leak. I never figured it out. The police investigated. They checked the detector. Someone had definitely removed the batteries, but there were no fingerprints, no signs of forced entry. Nothing on our security cameras. The gas leak was deemed accidental, a faulty connection that had been slowly deteriorating. But who disabled the detector? And who called me? To this day, I still check our carbon monoxide detector obsessively. Sometimes, late at night, I wonder if I should call my own number, just to see what happens. But I'm too terrified of what might answer. My family thinks I somehow figured it out on my own and don't remember clearly because of the stress. But I know what happened. I know what I heard. Someone or something warned me. Someone with my own voice, calling from my own number. Who knew exactly what was going to happen? I'll never forget those words. Don't come home tonight. Even though I was already home.
Story 3.
I saw my shadow move when I didn't. It was early evening in Kyoto, the kind of quiet hour when the air feels too still and the sky is a deep violet before night takes over. Yuki was walking home from cram school, her backpack heavy and her steps echoing through narrow streets lined with wooden houses. The lanterns had just come on, swaying faintly in the wind. That's when she noticed it. Her shadow wasn't quite right. At first, it lagged behind like a slow echo. She stopped. It didn't. Her breath caught. She blinked, and it froze again, matching her shape perfectly. Maybe her eyes were tired. Maybe she was imagining things. She started walking faster. The shadow followed. Kyoto's alleys at night could be beautiful or terrifying, depending on how your mind worked. For Yuki, they were both. The air smelled of rain and stone, and the sound of a distant temple bell rolled softly across the rooftops. She turned onto a quiet lane and looked down again. Her shadow was gone. She froze. The ground beneath her feet was smooth and pale under the streetlight. There should have been a shadow, but there wasn't. Only light, stretching out empty. A chill crept up her spine. Behind her, a soft shuffle broke the silence. She turned. Nothing. Just the same empty street. Yuki ran the rest of the way home. Her grandmother, who lived with her, was in the kitchen, slicing daikon for soup. "You're pale, child," she said, not looking up. "You saw something, didn't you?" Yuki hesitated. "I think my shadow disappeared." Grandmother's knife paused midair. The old woman looked up slowly, her cloudy eyes sharp despite the years. "When a shadow leaves, it means something else has taken its place." Yuki frowned. "Something else?" Grandmother only nodded and went back to cutting. "Stay in bright light tonight." The word stayed with Yuki long after dinner. Her room was small, but cozy, lined with anime posters and stacks of books. She switched on her desk lamp, flooding the space with warm light. But even then, she couldn't stop glancing at the floor. Her shadow was back, where it should be, but somehow it looked darker. As she reached to turn a page, the lamp flickered, and her shadow's hand didn't move. The light blinked twice more, and then the bulb went out completely. Darkness swallowed the room. "Not funny," Yuki whispered to no one. She grabbed her phone to use the flashlight. When the light came on, she aimed it at the wall. Her shadow stood tall and still, the edges sharp. But then slowly, it lifted its hand and waved. Yuki dropped her phone. The light spun across the floor, bouncing wildly, shadows shifting everywhere. She lunged to grab it, heart hammering, but before she could, something cold brushed her ankle. She froze. "Yuki." The whisper was faint, like wind through paper. Her breath hitched. "Who's there?" The air turned icy. Her books rustled on their own. The window trembled, though it was closed. Then, from the darkness, her shadow stepped forward. It didn't peel off the wall. It flowed out, like ink in water, shaping into something almost human. A black outline of her own body, except the face was smooth and featureless. It tilted its head at her, curious. Yuki stumbled back. "Stay away." The shadow tilted its head again, mimicking her fear. And then it smiled. No mouth should have been there, but it smiled anyway, a thin white curve peering out of the dark. Yuki bolted for the door, flung it open, and ran down the hall. Grandmother's room was dark too. "Oba-san," she cried, "it's here." The old woman appeared in the doorway, holding a small paper charm. "I told you to stay in the light," she said softly. "The Kageyama follows those who forget their prayers. Once she chooses, she won't let go."
"The what?"
Yuki's voice trembled. "The Shadow Woman," Grandmother said, "a spirit that lost her own body long ago. She finds others to live through. You must not show fear."
"I'm already scared."
"Then she's already winning." A sound came from Yuki's room. A faint laugh, childlike but wrong. The lights down the hall began to blink off one by one. Grandmother pressed the charm into Yuki's hand. "Go to the temple. The light there can drive her away."
"But what about you?"
"Go." Yuki didn't argue. She slipped on her shoes, clutched the charm, and ran into the night. Outside, the streets were nearly empty. The rain had stopped, leaving the air heavy and still. Every light she passed flickered. Her shadow stretched along the ground, darker than the night itself, sliding ahead of her instead of following behind. She ran faster. Lanterns dimmed as she passed. The air buzzed like an old TV. She could hear footsteps behind her, echoing hers. But when she looked back, no one was there. "Almost there," she whispered to herself. The temple gate was just ahead, its wooden beams glowing faintly gold under the lamps. Then the lamps went out. Her own reflection flickered in a puddle. Except in it, she wasn't running. The girl in the water stood perfectly still and smiling. Yuki screamed and sprinted through the gate. The temple courtyard was dark except for a single candle burning before the shrine. She dropped to her knees in front of it, clutching the charm so hard it dug into her palm. "Please," she whispered. "Please stop." The shadow caught up. It circled her like smoke, whispering in 100 voices at once. "You left the light. You left the light." Tears streamed down her cheeks. "What do you want?" The whisper came from right beside her ear. "To be you." The candle flared suddenly, light bursting across the courtyard. The shadow screamed, or something close to it, and recoiled, its shape twisting, unraveling into black ribbons that melted into the air. Yuki gasped, staring at the candlelight flickering on her trembling hands. Slowly, she lifted her head. Her shadow lay flat and quiet on the ground where it belonged. It was over. Or so she thought. Days passed. Life returned to normal. She didn't talk about it, though sometimes she caught her grandmother staring at her with worry in her eyes. Yuki avoided dark places, slept with the lamp on, and stayed near light whenever she could. But one night, a week later, she forgot. Her lamp went out while she was drawing. She sighed, too tired to get up. "It's fine," she murmured, turning toward her window. Moonlight spilled gently into the room, soft and silver. Then, on the paper she'd been sketching, her pencil moved on its own. It drew a single black line, then another, and another. The lines formed a smile. Yuki's heart stopped. She looked down. Her hand wasn't holding the pencil anymore, but her shadow was. The lines grew darker, heavier, until they filled the whole page in black. From the corner of her room came the soft sound of something stepping out of the wall. "Yuki," it whispered again, in her own voice this time, smooth and sure. "You left the light.